This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hello, and welcome to the Why We Argue podcast. I am Robert Talese. I'm professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University. Why We Argue is produced by Humility and Conviction in Public Life, a project based at the University of Connecticut, which explores how to balance our deepest commitments with open-mindedness, a respect for reason, and intellectual humility. The series, which is made possible by generous funding from the John Templeton Foundation, features brief discussions with publicly minded thinkers about the state of civil discourse in contemporary democracy. Today, my guest is Akhil Bilgrami. Akhil is the Sidney Morganbesser Professor of Philosophy and a faculty member of the Committee on Global Thought at Columbia University. Akhil's research spans issues in philosophy of mind, philosophy of language, moral philosophy, and political philosophy. His most recent book is titled Secularism, Identity, and Enchantment. He is also the author of the forthcoming book, What is a Muslim? Hello, Akhil.
Hello.
How are you doing today?
Fine, thanks.
Great. So, Akhil, many think that the country, the United States, is uncommonly politically polarized today, and arguably the divisions largely track religious and ethnic identities. Now, it's long been a challenge for modern democracy and its theorists to bring together a diverse population into a proper, maybe unified, citizenry in a way that respects their differences, the differences of the individual citizens, while also giving due acknowledgement to the fact that in a democracy, as John Rawls put it, we share each other's fate. Now, I take it that this standing challenge is formidable even under the best social and political circumstances. And the present circumstances are arguably far from favorable. There's a growing pressure, I think, to conceive of ethnic and religious identities as exclusive in the following sense. Many see their identity as bound up with a refusal to share the social fate of others, particularly those others who embody different social, religious, ethnic identities, or at least certain of these identities. Accordingly, it seems that maybe the very idea of a democratic people, of a democratic citizenry, is being transformed or perhaps jeopardized. What do you think we should make of this?
Well, you know, Bob, I think that we first should look at it historically a bit and then try and analyze the situation in America and other places.
Great.
The problem you're describing really emerged as a result of the destruction of relatively unselfconscious, pluralistic ways of life in Europe, as a result of nation building that emerged after the Westphalian Peace in Europe in the middle of the 17th century onwards. The idea of a nation emerged in that period for the first time. And much of the nation building that occurred in Europe was a result of a very self-conscious strategy in which these territories that had newly become nations found an external enemy within and despised it and subjugated it and said, the nation is ours, not theirs. And that was the beginning of nation building since the Westphalian Peace. Much later, it came to be called nationalism. And after numerical forms of discourse and statistics became part of the tools by which to study society, it began to be called majoritarianism, because you've got these notions of majority and minority analyzing societies. And it began to be majoritarianism as a way of nation building, as I said, pointing out, the majority pointing out that the nation is ours. And often the majorities were religious majorities. So this, you know, the despised minorities were Jews or the Irish or the Protestants in Catholic countries or the Catholics in Protestant countries. And that's Europe. That's the history of Europe. It's the history of nations as they emerged in Europe. So it's a very long-standing history. And of course, one focuses on the very apocalyptic, spectacular case of Germany in the 1930s and 40s, but it's really a very long-standing history. And a a lot of these notions of secularism and so on emerged in order to repair the damage caused by this form of nationalism or nation building. So, for instance, when there was this religious majoritarianism that began to construct nations along these methods, there were obviously minoritarian religious backlashes to it. And as a result, it began to be thought that religion itself was the problem. Even though it started with religious majoritarianism, because there were minoritarian backlashes to it, the civil strife caused a lot of damage, and it was to repair that damage with that history that the notion of secularism emerged in Europe. And I think the way to understand the loss of pluralism, the loss of people living side by side completely unselfconsciously, is to understand this history of nationalism, which is now being replayed in different parts of the world, especially Europe, and including my country, India.
Right. And so one of the implications of the history that you've just summarized very nicely is that the idea of a religiously or perhaps even ethnically pluralistic state has become challenged in a certain way. We see this particularly in the United States today, but also, I'm sad to say, throughout Europe, with declarations that, as you had just put it, the country, the nation, belongs to us, where the us is identified as an ethnic, some combination of ethnic and religious identity, as a way of declaring that the country, the state, the nation does not belong to others who in fact inhabit it and have inhabited it peacefully and dutifully for generations. Is that right?
That's right. But now I think we need to try and identify the similarities and the differences between a country like the United States and Europe. You see, in the United States is a country which is a secularist country, but it's not very secularized.
Right.
And I think we need to make a really clean, relatively clean distinction between secularism and secularization. Secularization is really a process that Max Weber first talked about, and it's the loss of belief in God and in creation myths and in the loss of religious ritual and practice. Secularism is a completely different idea. It's a much more specific notion. It's the idea of keeping religion out of the orbit of the polity. And that is a quite different idea from the idea of losing belief in religious and ceasing to have religious practices and rituals. So it's perfectly possible for a country to be highly non-secularized, as America is, because there's still, you know, a great deal of religious belief, church going, which there isn't in Europe. I was in a church in Paris on a Sunday, and there were three people in it.
Right, they're more like historical and museum-like structures.
Exactly. So America is not secularized, but it's a secularist country, right? So and Iran is neither secularized nor secularist. Now, what is interesting is that one question you might ask is, why is Europe so different from America in this respect? That is, that there's almost no religious belief and practice of the kind that there is in a country like the United States. And I think the answer is that in Europe, the human urge for solidarity and community for over a century, and century and a half almost by now, came from the rise of social democracy and labor politics. People, the emergence of unions, trade unions and union halls and so on, gave people a place to go to for community and solidarity. And that is a very deep part of European history of the last century or more. And it's an interesting thing that in England, for instance, it came out of religious nonconformism. Labor movements came out of religious nonconformism. So it isn't as if religion had no role to play in the rise of social democracy. It had a very big role to play in Europe. But the urge, which we all have as human beings for communal relations, for community and feelings of solidarity and fraternity, came from the church for centuries, but were replaced in Europe by a really strong social democratic labor source of community. That never really caught on in the United States, and it's especially weak now. And as a result, church going and so on is really, the statistics of that are amazing, especially in the heartland. And so that's one major difference between Europe and the United States. On the other hand, there is the following similarity. You see, you said that there's a great polarization of society along religious lines. Now, that is true. The heartland is very religious in this country, and the coasts are relatively, they're more like Europe, to right. some extent anyway. But the point is that the polarization also is an economic and a class polarization. And you know, economists have really begun to study inequality now in depth. So Joseph Stiglitz, Piketty's book, which made such a splash, these have become real issues. And I don't think you can understand the rise of these populists in these countries without in Europe and here, without understanding how deep the class divisions have become.
Well, that seems right. There is a puzzle, though, it seems to me, that certainly the economic dimensions that you were just mentioning look from the perspective of an academic like myself and like you, the right tool to pick up to start analyzing and explaining. The additional puzzle, though, is that those economic features of the situation within the United States today are often not part of the explanation or not part of the narrative that the people who feel aggrieved, the people who are expressing the need to take the country back or to identify who the real Americans are and who needs to go or be prevented from coming. That's not part of their narrative, right? Their narrative does look more overtly ethnic, religious, geographical. Now, we as academics might think that those are proxies or the sort of epiphenomena of more fundamental economic forces. You don't have to be a Marxist to think that kind of thought. But do you think that there's some explanation as to why the economics of the situation are usually just are beneath the surface?
Well, yeah. Now, so let's take Brexit for a moment.
Sure.
All right. So, and let's take what happened in Greece and with the rise of Podemos in Spain and so on. You see, imagine a working person or a workless person in the Thames Estuary. Or in Madrid and Seville or Crete or Athens, such a person might ponder what happened in Europe after the Second World War, and he might ponder what the humane policies that were adopted by many European governments, providing welfare and safety nets in housing, in education, and health, and he might ask, well, at what site did these humane policies get devised and implemented? And he would obviously answer, at the site of the nation. He might scratch his head and ask, well, what supranational site has ever administered safety nets and welfare in housing and education and health? In fact, he might say, I can't even imagine what a mechanism for welfare looks like at a supranational site like Europe. It has always been administered at the site of a nation. One doesn't even know how to begin to think about how it would be dispensed at a supranational site. Those are very good questions, and they define for me the good side of populism, and I think ordinary working people are asking questions like that. Now, they also go on to think of the supranational affiliation that these countries have adopted as giving rise to immigrant hordes who deprive them of their economic opportunities and who come and undermine their centuries-long national culture of which they are so proud and so on. Now these further things that such a person might think over and above asking those excellent questions has no logical link with the excellent questions. And I think that making of an illogical, uncompulsory link between sound questions and unsound anxieties is the bad side of populism. And I think This is an amalgam of sound and unsound thinking that it defines populism today. And now the question you no doubt are keen to ask when I say this is, but why is this illogical and uncompulsory link? What is the compulsion to link it that is everywhere present in Europe and in the United States as well? And here I think we simply must resist the temptation to blame the people. You see, it's very tempting to, when a bad result comes out of an election or a referendum, it's very tempting to blame the people as being racist or xenophobic. Because after all, people are shaped by what they learn from the media, what they learn from the political establishment and the political class. Let me just give you an example. It's not the extreme right which started saying horrid things about immigration in Britain. It was just look at the Remain campaign by the British Prime Minister. It's Cameron who repeatedly wanted to own the immigration issue, take it away from the extreme right, and he said absolutely terrible things about immigration. Also, consider the fact that in the 2008 elections, Obama was much worse on immigration than McCain. And that's because he wanted to take away the immigration platform from the Republicans. So the entire political establishment has been terrible on immigration whenever it comes close to elections. And it's not just the extreme right. It's not just Trump. It was Obama in 2008. It was Cameron during the Remain campaign. And so if the whole political class and the tabloid and media, television media and so on, that are constantly shaping people's minds, I think there is a lot to diagnose here, which comes from institutions of this kind and the whole political establishment. And they shape the electorate's thinking. You can't believe in democracy and dismiss half the nation's electorate as vile or stupid. That's not compatible with a belief in democracy. If you believe in democracy, you just can't do that, because the electorate and the ordinary people are shaped by the knowledges they possess. And if they make this illogical link, there's something wrong in the public education that is being provided by a whole range of institutions. That's what a Democrat has to say. A Democrat with a small d has to say. And, you know, because for 2,000 years, philosophers have said that the central ethical question is, what ought we to do? But I think we live in such a complex time that the crucial prior question has to be, what ought we to know?
Excellent. That's completely compelling. And I think that you're right that the easy and blaming responses to what many find is a very unsettling election result, the blame the people for being xenophobic or ignorant or racist or worse, is too easy. But to pick up on the what I think is a compelling sort of alternate to the how ought we live, which is what ought we to learn, or how what do we need to know? Do you have any sort of big picture lessons about how we might go about addressing that more pressing question as you just formulated it?
Yes, sure. You know, there's this hysteria and hand-wringing with Trump's victory that I find amongst my colleagues and amongst my students, actually, and it's everywhere in the liberal press. But look, my view about what has to be done, it depends a little bit on how we understand what just happened. You see, I think let's just take the last election. Hillary Clinton is about as establishment a political figure as you can find in the United States. Now, the Democratic Party undermined the campaign of Bernie Sanders subtly at the beginning, and when he started really catching on in the primaries, they did it quite openly. Now, there's this constant sneering about Sanders' populism, and I don't deny for a moment that I think it goes without saying that Hillary Clinton would have been better than Trump. But if it goes without saying, don't say it. Because if you keep saying it, you're going to give rise to the complacence that the political establishment, of which she's absolutely the center in this country, and what she represents, including her husband, who was the former president, this is, you've got to understand why people don't like the Clintons. Of course, it is false consciousness to say that Trump is going to do something for the white working population, which is his constituency. But there was just as classic a case of false consciousness when African Americans voted for Hillary Clinton rather than Sanders in the primaries. Bill Clinton was just about as the worst president in modern times for if you consider the material interests of the blacks. He the notorious welfare bill, which is the anti-welfare bill that he introduced and passed, is something that the blacks have never registered as as a reason to vote against Hillary Clinton. She has the same economic ideology as Bill Clinton. Sanders actually would have been done much more for their material interests. It's true that the Clintons are not socially speaking racists, but the fact is that the African Americans would have been much better off under Sanders' policies than under Hillary Clinton. So there's false consciousness everywhere. And I think that it would be a great mistake to allow the fact that one thinks Clinton would have been better than Trump to become a form of complacence for doing nothing about the Democratic Party as it currently exists. The resistance to what happened, resistance to Trump's presidency, ought to be a movement to steer the Democratic Party away from the classic establishment it has become under the Clintons. And I think that ought to be the lesson we learn from Trump's victory. But I don't believe we'll learn it. I think the Democratic Party's learning curve is pretty much flat. And so it's not going to learn this lesson. And, you know, it's a very simple thing to historically diagnose this. The real victory of people like Reagan and Thatcher was not just that they introduced the right wing, but they made the left wing into center-right parties. Blair basically divorced the Labour Party from Labour, and Bill Clinton just basically divorced the Democratic Party from its sort of rainbow constituency that it had for years, all through the Johnson era and so on. So I think that if there's any lesson to be learned, it ought to be that we ought to try and make the Democratic Party much less of an establishment party than it has been. But I don't think that the Democratic Party is going to be an easy thing to do, because that party really, as I said, learns very little from elections in the last two or three decades.
And do you think, what role do you think, or maybe the question is, how might we sort of approaching what you identified earlier as the invalid inference that's at the heart of populism? Is there any way that you could think of how that might be? It seems to me that's got to be part of the puzzle, right? Remaking a party seems to be an important thing, but maybe not sufficient.
Well, I mean, I think that it's not sufficient. I agree with you, but you know, there are just lots of different necessary things that have to be done. And I don't think anybody can say what would be sufficient. But I think there is real point to a lot of questions that are being asked about Brexit, about a whole range of questions that oppose the globalization of finance capital and the neoliberal policies that it entails. And I think what we need is, and Sanders did his bit to bring that onto center stage. And I think that in Europe, there is an effort by some parties to do that. But the point is that none of them realize that you simply might have to think of Europe as something to break away from. But you can't do that unless you really resolve to have a genuine left movement, what was called Lexit by a whole range of leftist activists. And I think, and certainly for many parts of the world, such as the part of the world that I come from, it may be very important to de-link from the globalized financial capital that really, in many ways, destroys the sovereignties that nations have to control the future of their own economies. Look, take the fact that somebody like Lula was elected in Brazil with a very humane and progressive political platform. He couldn't implement it at all. Why? Because of an anxiety about capital flight. That's what a globalized finance capital-based economy does, right? It allows capital to move out at the press of a button. That's something that was unleashed by the remantling of the Bretton Woods institutions 30 years ago or more. And as a result, it's very difficult for national governments to do things for ordinary people in their country because of an anxiety about capital flight. Now, that anxiety can't be fought unless you de-link from the global economy.
Right.
And I think something like that is there in the urges of ordinary people in what I'm calling populism in the good sense. And I think we need political economists, politicians, activists, and so on to really think very hard about these issues.
Well, that's wonderful. Akhil, you've been very generous with your time, and I want to thank you once again for joining me on the Why We Argue podcast. And thank you, listener, for tuning in to the podcast. I remind you that the Why We Argue podcast is produced by the University of Connecticut's Humility and Conviction in Public Life Project with generous support from the John Templeton Foundation. You can follow the project on Twitter and on Facebook at Public Humility, one word. Thank you, and bye for now.